quiet. Okay, that's fine. Now, ki ein hatsar shova means for the adversary is not worthy of the king's damage. Does anyone know what that means? that's a difficult... What does that mean? The adversary, I assume, is Haman. Haman is the tsar. The adversary is not worthy of the king's damage. Now, that makes sense if it's connected to the earlier verse, meaning to say, Haman shouldn't have the right to cause the king such damage. See, it's syntactically, its position in the second part of the verse doesn't make a lot of sense, because it seems to be connected to why Esther would have been silent. In other words, it seems to be saying, had we been sold as slaves, I would have been silent because what it says. But the way the translation works, it's not giving a reason for that. It would seem to be going back to the first idea that I am speaking up not merely because of my people, but because the adversary is destroying the king's, people that would give money to the king. In other words, she's basically playing, according to this pshat, this translation, she's basically playing on Achashverosh's selfishness and his parochial interest, meaning she's saying, listen, Achashverosh, you're not going to get anything out of this. Haman is actually hurting you by eradicating the Jews. In other words, Ein Hatsar, the adversary, is not worthy to cause the king this type of destruction. In other words, what's the destruction? The destruction would be the destruction of the Jews. In other words, she's pitching the parochial argument that says to Achashverosh, hey Achashverosh, the destruction of the Jewish people will be bad for you. Let me just see how Rashi, could you pass me that verse there? Let me see how Rashi interprets the phrase. This, by the way, is one of the most difficult, the most difficult psukim to translate in the Megillah.
I thought Achashverosh didn't care.
Well, but that's why she seems to be making the point of economics involved, meaning Jews contribute a lot of taxes, there's a lot of money that comes in.
Oh, she's saying that you're going to lose because you're not going to be losing on money.
That's what she's saying, yeah. In other words, Haman is causing you damage. Oh, okay. Do we have anything? Okay.
We see that it really doesn't make a difference to him because he turned away.
They don't have any commentary for that. They just have the Megillah. There's no Hirsch commentary in the Megillah.
Achashverosh turns away Haman's $200 million earlier.
Right. That's a very good kasha. I mean, if she's simply saying that Achashverosh is going to lose economically from it, she should already have known that that's a losing argument, really, per se, because Achashverosh turned down a tremendous amount of money. Remember, Haman offered him a tremendous 10,000 kikar kesef. Now, some translate the pasuk exactly the opposite. Some translate the pasuk to say the following, and this actually fits the continuity better. If we simply would have been slaves, I would have kept quiet, because our suffering wouldn't be worth the inconvenience of His Majesty's time. In other words, I wouldn't have bothered to bring it to your attention. In other words, if it wouldn't be a matter of life and death, the tsar meaning the pain that we are going through as being slaves, would not be worthwhile to inconvenience the king. In other words, she's making the point, if it wouldn't be a matter of life and death, I wouldn't have brought anything up. Yeah.
Maybe this is in left field, but I took this phrase to be belittling Haman. Mm-hmm. That it was just basically saying he's not really worth your while. You know, if it had just been slavery, he's small potatoes. He's not worthy of your attention. Mm-hmm. But because of this, I'm bringing it up to you.
In other words, he is too insignificant.
He's insignificant. Therefore, it's only because of this thing that I'm bringing it up.
Right. So the king's damage means the king's involvement.
His involvement.
In other words, for you to get involved is wasting your time, as
wasting
it were.
Wasting your time because he's small potatoes. But
yeah. So according to that, the nezek hamelech, the damage of the king, refers to the damage of getting involved in this whole process. So if it would have been something small, such as being slaved, we wouldn't have even troubled you to get involved in this guy. But since it's genocide, we have to step forward. You know. Now, again, though, it's reminiscent a little bit of the fact that even in Nazi Germany, you know, if Adolf Hitler wanted to rule the world, then in a way, to do this was not a good way for him to even accomplish his goal. Because, as you know, some of the people who left Germany, Albert Einstein for one, you know, were the most brilliant scientists in the world. Besides those that he killed, were also those who left, etc., and they actually contributed to the...
It was the remnants of German technology that started the American
space. Right. Yeah. Even from the non-Jewish sites. Yeah, that's correct. Werner von Braun, etc. But of course, I think what that tells you is a big chiddush, not a chiddush really, but something very interesting about Hitler and Nazism, and that is, it wasn't the pshat. Yes, Hitler had a number of goals, conquer the world, etc., but the big goal was to destroy the Jewish people. That's Amalek. Everything else was secondary. And Hitler could have won the war. Hitler could have won World War II had he not been so insanely single-minded, as Amalek is, for the destruction.
He had left alone Russia.
That's right.
Because he wanted the Jews there.
That's correct.
He's left
alone
Russia, he could have won the war.
And that is the hallmark of Amalek. Amalek is the all-consuming hatred for holiness that doesn't even make sense from the political lesson. In fact, it's well known that one example is Russia, the other example is Rommel in North Africa, that, you know, indeed, if Hitler wasn't so busy trying to kill, you know, half-dead Jews in Polish concentration camps, you know, who were, you know, powerless and couldn't do anything to him, he could have devoted many, many more resources in military campaigns. And that's Amalek. Amalek is consumed by blind hatred for Kedusha. So Esther is making the point that Haman himself is not worth your time, but he's planning on doing something bad.
I think the main point is that he's going to step with the right. People diverted often resources toward the killing of Jews, which he didn't warrant. About the first point about expelling the Jewish scientists who were the great part. I'm not sure, because he had a whole conception of Aryan science and the purity, and it's not irrelevant now, but the question about his madness was so great that he couldn't even conceive of the achievements of Jews in which were so cardinal.
I understand that, but I think all of that is connected, meaning to say it was the blind, uncontrollable hatred that made him define the world in those fundamentally irrational ways. So you're correct. It may very well be that within the confines of his delusions, it was logical to get rid of degenerate science, or whatever it was. But what we get Albert Einstein as a degenerate scientist from the hatred of the heart, so... It still is connected to that sin of Amalek.
There's something about the Germans, though, that, I mean, regardless of the Jewish presence, the Germans themselves have some sort of ability to be very industrious and successful in material ways.
Sure.
I mean, they bounce back World War II, then they bounce back after, World War I, then after World War II, and now they're one of the leading industrial nations in the world today. There aren't any Jewish presence like there used to be.
It's very true. I mean, of course, on the other hand, I remember reading many, many years ago, you know, the novel Catch-22, a famous book about the satire, but it's about World War II. And in the book, the author, Joseph Heller, who happens to be Jewish, makes the point, it's a very, very cute scene, it's about some old Italian guy in Rome.
In the Bordello.
Right, that makes the point that it's much, much better to lose a war with America than to win it. Because when you lose a war with America, you know, they come with a Marshall Plan and they give you billions of dollars and everything else. If you win, they kind of ignore you. So he says, you know, you really win the war with America when you lose it. So he says, so Germany, you know, lost the war, but they get built up. But Japan, etc.
The important point that the great achievement of Germany's culture and the great Beethoven and Bach of all of their history and the connection and the love of the absolute Faustian theme which goes to the connection of people is also Thomas Mann's book about the Faustians. separate on these things, as the, of the greatness of the power of creation, mm-hmm. based on the power of destruction. I think that the whole question is, and for the whole enlightened, civilized Western world, was really related, I'm sorry, to, was really related to this question of how these people were so great in achievement, capable of such evil. But if you look at German history, and the history also in relation to it's rooted in this kind of destruction.
That's
the other side of it.
Well, there's no question, and in fact, it has to be connected because right, God is ultimately showing us that Amalek can be capable of the greatest achievements, but if it's not rooted in submission to God, it'll turn into total destruction. In other words, it's no accident that the Holocaust, as the Meshech Chachma writes, did not emanate. Although the victims were in Poland, etc., but it did not emanate from a primitive, backward, downtrodden place, but it emanated from the greatest cultural and scientific center, really, of the world, or certainly of Europe. Because Hashem is showing us that when you separate yourself, all of that culture could very easily turn into destruction, turn into evil. And as people often say, the issue of the Holocaust is profoundly difficult. Obviously, the issue of why righteous people suffer is the most difficult question of religion. But the real question of Auschwitz is not where was God, but where was man. In other words, Auschwitz tells us a lot more about what human beings are capable of than it tells us about God. God, for reasons that only He knows, allows things to happen. But the actual perpetrators were human beings who made Bechira. So what does it tell us about human beings? People always talk about it as some accusation about God. But it tells us indeed that the greatest culture can be predicated into tremendous destruction. And we mentioned yesterday that even Amalek is not necessarily going to be characterized, as it were, by wild, uncivilized, raving and ranting. Amalek can be characterized by great civilization, but it's lo yarei Elokim, does not accept submission to the will of Hashem.
I don't have any knowledge of this at all, but I want to ask you about this question. You just talked about the Germans. Isn't it a total view on national characteristics of people and their relative coordination? Do we have a tradition that certain people have been more friendly with us at this time?
Well, Chazal, the Torah doesn't specifically talk about it, but Chazal identify nations as having certain characteristics. Now, Germany is complicated. There are some that have a tradition that Germany is Amalek. Although it's not clear if that means they're genealogically Amalek, or are they simply, have the characteristics of wanting to destroy Klal Yisrael. Actually, there's an old tradition, I think, from Rav Sadia Gaon, that says Amalek of all people are the Armenians. Although, it's hard to know in particular what encounters Armenians have had with Jews. We have the Armenian quarter here in the Old City, but there is a tradition that Armenia might be Amalek.
And there's an interesting thing that Armenian Jews have been traditionally friendly in the United States, but now there's a conflict between the Armenian army and the Israeli army.
Okay. Well, you never know.
It's very far from...
You never know. But certainly, in Kabbalah, it is taught that the 70 nations of the world, each of them have a unique national character that defines their relationship. But I've never really seen any detailed working outs, other than a few things like, Yefes, which is Greece, is lover of beauty and aesthetics, etc. But you don't really see that much detail. But again, just to keep in mind, I'm just throwing out associations. One of the children of Yefes, Yefes is one of Noah's children, right? So Shem, Chum, and Yefes. So Chum is the Canaanites and the African nations. Yefes are the Greeks, Greek culture, not the modern Greeks, but the ancient Greeks. One of Yefes's children is Ashkenaz, is the name of one of Yefes's children. And Ashkenaz was identified very early as Germany. Even today, in modern Ashkenaz is Germania. And consequently, it's interesting that the German personality is connected to the ancient Greek personality in terms of lover of beauty, of symmetry, of precision. And even the militaristic aspect of Germany
could be traced to Sparta, because Greece also, I mean, there was Athens, or Athens and Sparta. Germany, in effect, is kind of a union of Athens and Sparta. You know, Athens in terms of the philosophy and aesthetics, Sparta in terms of the discipline and the militarism. So in that sense, it's really no accident that the sense of beauty coupled with the militarism is connected to Iephis. But of course, I just want to say one thing. You have to be careful here not to be inconsistent in your genealogy, because if you identify Ashkenaz as coming from Iephis, then genealogically it could not be Amalek, because Amalek is a Semitic people, because Amalek is the grandson of Esav, who comes from Avram, who comes from Shem, right? So you have to be careful. Sometimes these identifications contradict each other. But, you know, of course, in the course of time, it's certainly possible there are common streams of the different families that interbred and created that idea. So that's just a thought, but, you know, obviously you have to work it out a bit more. So again, Ahasuerus plays dumb, or is dumb, as he always is, meaning all of a sudden Esther drops this bombshell: my life is in danger, my people are in danger. Of course, Ahasuerus, till this moment, doesn't know who her people are. And of course he doesn't know who's planning this, and he says, who is this? Who would think of such a thing? And Esther says in Pasuk Vav, Vatomer Esther, Ish Tsar V'Oyev, a man who is an adversary and an enemy. And the Gemara actually says very dramatically that she was about to point to Ahasuerus and say, you are the guy that authorized this. But the Malach Gavriel, the angel, thought that would not be a good idea to blame the king. So she starts saying, Ish Tsar V'Oyev, and the Malach hits her hand to point to the other direction. And then she's pointing to him, Haman. She's off. Haman! Haro Hazem.
You know, even at this point, she doesn't say that she's Jewish and it's the Jewish people who are going to be destroyed.
That's correct. That's correct. The king would have to put two and two together. She just made the statement that this guy wants to destroy me and my people. Now, presumably, Ahasuerus has some recollection, although he may have been drunk at the time, that he did authorize Haman to get rid of a people. But remember, we discussed, we didn't even know if he knew they were Jewish then. Now, if he doesn't know they were Jewish then, right, he doesn't know they're Jewish now. If he did know they were Jewish then, it's not clear he's making the connection to what he authorized, because maybe this is some other plan Haman is hatching, you know, behind his back. Right? So it's not really clear that Ahasuerus even has a sense of connecting this with that earlier thing, of which he's at least a co-conspirator.
Well, at this point, what she's accusing him of, primarily, I mean, there's the thing about the people, but he's accusing Haman of being a traitor to the crown.
That's right, that's right, that's right. She's playing on Ahasuerus's own self-interest.
You'd almost get the impression that it's like, it wasn't any big deal, Ahasuerus. Oh, wipe out of people.
Well,
there's
no question. The Gemara makes the point. The Gemara makes the point that right after Ahasuerus gives Haman this authorization, they sit down and they drink and they have a party. And the Gemara makes the point: this was not a celebratory party per se. This was a party like, okay, we finished the business for today, let's sit down and have lunch. Meaning, there was a certain callousness in this approach. There was no sense of any type of taking this seriously. That goes back really, again, that's interesting, because that's kind of different than Amalek. You know, you have Hannah Arendt, famous, who's a Jewish woman, not a religious one, a famous political scientist and philosopher. She wrote a well-known book after the Eichmann trial called The Banality of Evil. And her thesis was, and she looked at a guy, Einstein. Of course, Einstein was already before many of you were born. I remember the Einstein trial as a first grader or something. I'm sorry about that. As a first grader. But, you know, Eichmann was a mild-mannered guy, a bureaucrat, someone who pushed paper, somebody who wanted to make sure all the records were in order. You know, had there not been a war, you know, he would have been in some, he would have been an insurance agent or something like that. And she was just amazed that here you have a guy who's not overpowering in his evil and in his anger and in his passion and in his hate. Just a guy that does this thing as a matter of routine. So she had a whole different vision. She called it the banality of evil, meaning sometimes evil does not come into the guise of, let's say, Hitler himself, where you see, you know, the anger and the outrage that is within, but it's just a person who just goes through the motions.
That's why we have such an incredible record of the Holocaust, because of the minute records that were
kept. Right. It wasn't a big deal. It was just something you did. You kept the records every day, etc. And a lot of the Germans, a lot of the Nazis, after a day of brutality against Jews, they would go to the concerts. They would go to the opera at night. And there's some pictures we have, just amazing things, of guys who just came from beating Jews, who would put out a saucer of milk for the wild cats that were wandering around, because, you know, God forbid, the cats should not. In fact, I've seen, like, testimonies of survivors in concentration camps that would say they would often envy the dogs and the cats, because the dogs and the cats would be so well treated and so cared for, and they would be looking and pining away for a crumb of bread or something. So that highlights the idea that you see perhaps in Ahasuerus, that Haman is kind of the Amalek of the Hitler, the one that is filled with outrage and hate. And Ahasuerus is the Eichmann, the banality of evil, in which it's not that Ahasuerus is necessarily a great hater of the Jews. He just doesn't care about what goes on, and it makes no difference to him. And a few hundred thousand people or a few million people, we don't know exactly how many people, die, you know, big deal. So it may represent those two aspects of evil that exist in the world.
I'm sorry, but yeah. I won't accept that.
Right.
I know it's not relevant.
Well, yeah, okay. It's not, yeah.
But I think that the whole idea of the banality of evil, I think it's true evil.
Yeah.
And the whole piece is ambitious. And I'd like to get into it here, but also the book itself, mm-hmm. I think it's much more, has very many ugly implications.
Okay, you know, I'm not reviewing the book, and as you know, what's the guy last year? Is it Goldhagen in Harvard? Daniel Goldhagen.
I mean, Goldhagen's
book is you know, directly argues with that Aaron Goldhagen. I mean, he argues that there was something in the German character, not so much Eichmann in particular, which was deliberately.
Germany knew about the Holocaust,
right.
And that the average person participated in a certain kind of way,
right.
in the whole...
Right, but his argument also is that it wasn't simply a question of not caring or indifference, but he says there was something active in the German character, which is really the opposite direction of Hannah Arendt's thesis. Again, I can't be machria, obviously, with regard to any specific personality. I think, however, her central insight that evil can exist in the world in one of two different forms, I think is a valid insight. I mean, how you fight in person is a matter of conjecture. But there is indeed the evil of indifference. Now, I wouldn't identify that with Amalek, indeed. And then you get into the problem. If Germany is Amalek, then it wouldn't be that way. But certainly, there is a concept in many statements of Chazal, that evil can exist by virtue of indifference and callousness, as well as active hate. In fact, this is expressed in the Gemara's teaching, that one who sees evil done in the world and does not protest to stop it, is considered to be guilty of that same aveira. In fact, there's a famous medrash. The medrash says that when Paro decided to destroy the Jewish babies, throw them into the river, there were three people who were with him in his council. One was Bilam, one was Yisro, and one was Ir, Job. Bilam said, sure, let's go ahead and do it. Bilam, of course, was the active evil that says, let's destroy them. And Bilam eventually met his fate. Yisro tried to dissuade Paro not to do it. And when he was unsuccessful, Yisro's life was threatened himself, and he ran away to Midian. And his eventual reward was Moshe Rabbeinu married his daughter, and Yisro became part of Klal Yisrael. Eev, it is said, simply remained silent. Eev did not endorse the idea, but Eev did not protest the idea either. And as a result, Eev
suffered all of the sufferings that Eob later suffered.
I'm sorry, how does it, Eob, if it just was?
Pyro is discussing genocide of the Jewish people. Eob does not speak up against it. Yeah, the person Job who later had all these bad things happen to him. So the Medrash places Eob as one of the three people in Pyro's council. Yeah, in other words, the Medrash says that why God brought all the sufferings of Eob upon Eob was his failure to protest Pyro's decree. So Bilam represents active hate. Yisro represents the struggle against evil. And Eob represents a certain measure of indifference. In fact, the Brisker Rav used to say, how could we blame Eob? Why should Eob speak up? Yisro spoke up and it didn't work. So Yisro just kept quiet. Of course, there are a few answers to that. One is, if more people speak up, they could make a difference. Even in Hitler's case, to go back, I mean, there are many, many interesting historical speculations of what would have happened if there would have been more protests, either within Germany or on the part of the international community, against the beginning. You know, Hitler basically started small. You know, Sudetenland, and, you know, then all that stuff, what's his name, Chamberlain, you know, gives it away to him, etc. We have peace in our time. Because there's a fascinating thing. Apparently, there were a small number of Jews who were married to German women, intermarried, hardly Frumden, who actually remained in Berlin for the entire duration of the war. And I believe in 1943 or 44, Hitler wanted to round them up and put them in concentration camps. And there was a protest in Berlin of around 500 women, just protest. A protest of 500 women, and the men were released. Protest, and it's, if you protested, you know, he collapsed right away. But nobody ever protested. Everybody went along with it. Right? I mean, it's really very, very amazing if something, you know. But be it as it may, so you could say that if he would have protested, maybe it would have made a difference. But the Brisker Rav gives another mahalach, a very interesting idea. The Brisker Rav said, yeah. Some of the it wasn't 100%, but it was very small. It was very, very small. But the Brisker Rebbe is a different mahalach about protesting evil. He says the following. He says, you know, when you step on a nail, you're going to scream out. Even though screaming doesn't do a single thing, but if it hurts, you cry. Conversely, therefore, when you don't cry, it means it doesn't hurt enough. Meaning, yes, maybe from a purely rational standpoint, Eve's protestations would have been totally ineffective. But when someone is discussing throwing babies into the water and killing them, you've got to speak out. If you don't speak out, that means you don't care enough. And that already justifies, Chazal say, all of the sufferings of Eve. Meaning protest is not merely because it will be effective. Protest reflects the feelings, in fact this applies to many types of protests, without addressing appropriate means of protest, that's a whole other discussion, but when things happen that are immoral, when things happen that are cruel, when things happen that are demeaning, when there's things that are a desecration of Hashem's kavod, there is a concept that, you know, one should register at least protest. Again, I'm not talking about violence or that. Means is a whole other issue. But the concept of registering protest, the Brisker Rav argues, is not a function of its probable effectiveness. It's a function of the depth of commitments that you feel towards the good and the revulsion you have towards the evil. Yep.
Is the Midrash the place of the evil?
Yes.
But that seems to contradict the general beginning of Eob, where God, you know, God himself testifies to Eob's righteousness. He says, is there anyone more righteous than Eob? Have you seen my servant Eob? And then the whole thing was just a bet. You know, let's put some pressure on him to see if he breaks.
I mean, this is a much more deeper understanding of the book of Eob, and that is, Eob's righteousness is primarily defined in negative terms.
he does not do anything bad. And one could argue that the whole purpose, in fact, the satan is actually l'shem shemayim here. The satan wants Eve to become a greater tzaddik by learning to do good. See, in other words, not speaking up is not a sin, but it's a certain flaw. It's not an aveira per se, but it's a flaw. It's a lack of sensitivity. And the whole experience was to elevate him to that greater level of sensitivity. It's not stam a bet. In other words, the satan is saying, Eev needs to be challenged to become transformed into a greater person than he otherwise would be. So, once again, we see this very important idea. In other words, I'm bringing this in just to show you that evil exists in the world in two forms. There is the virulent form of Amalek, which is consumed by hatred and rage. And then there difference of good. And by the way, it's very interesting. I think the Zohar actually says it's actually harder for tzaddikim to protest evil. The Zohar has the following judgment. Because by nature, it is the Yetzer Hara within a person that seeks activism and conflict. The Yetzer Hara is the ego within a person. The Yetzer Tov tends to be quiescent and passive and accepting of the will of God. The Yetzer Tov tends not to be the one that goes out and does things in some way. And therefore, this is a necessary idea where the tzaddik must draw upon the powers of the Yetzer Hara to kind of become the activist and become the protester. Now, of course, you see the dangers of political involvement, because when you use the powers of the Yetzer Hara, it is so easy to then be under the control of the Yetzer Hara, which is why political activism is such a dangerous thing. It's sometimes necessary, but it's very dangerous because it can corrupt the tzaddik into becoming power, right? But so there is this very delicate and difficult idea of seeing the tools of the Yetzer Hara, but using them exclusively in the service of good. Right. That's correct. Yeah.
We were talking in Rabbi Bertram's share that the Gemara brings a proof that learning Torah is more important than saving the world,
right?
Because after Korah, Mordechai's standing among the
Sanhedrin was diminished. Right, that's right, that's right. Now, the Gemara says, learning Torah is more important than saving lives. Now, that doesn't mean, you have to understand what that means. That obviously does not mean that if I'm learning Torah and somebody's drowning, I'm supposed to keep on learning. Obviously, I stop my learning and I save them. But what it does mean is, you still sacrifice a certain spiritual level that you would otherwise attain. Okay. So this is the idea of the multiple levels of evil. So, when Haman hears this, remember, Haman was led to believe that Queen Esther likes him because he's the special guest in the party. So Haman is all of a sudden taken aback. Nivas. Nivas means he's startled. This came out of left field. The king is too angry to even talk. He walks out, he runs out in anger, and he runs into the garden. So here the Gemara has an interesting little point, that there's a certain detail in the story that's not recorded in the text of the Megillah, but in fact it's there, that he's walking into the garden, and all of a sudden he sees this man cutting down his favorite fruit trees. Cutting down the tree. He says, "What's going on?" He says, "Oh, Haman gave us a call this morning," and this was an angel. "Haman gave us a call this morning and said to destroy all your trees." See that? So he then runs in. Now again, the Megillah says Haman is begging Esther for his life, but again, the Gemara gives some interesting details here. And that is, Haman got on his knees to Esther, who is reclining on a couch, you know, at the banquets. Just in Greek and Roman and Persian banquets as well, people would recline on couches. In fact, that's really the way a Pesach Seder should be. Now, no one does the Pesach Seder right. You know, recline on a table, you know. That's not really reclining. Reclining is everybody has their couch, and they're on their couch, you know, and they're eating. So Esther's reclining on the couch. Haman is on his knees,
And an angel, just as Ahasuerus walks in, an angel pushes Esther into Ahasuerus's, I'm sorry, pushes Haman into Esther's lap. So he walks out, you know, he sees his best trees being cut down. He walks in, he sees, you know, Haman apparently sexually connected to Esther, and he utters the famous words, Hagam lichbosh es hamalka imi babayas. Are you trying to conquer the queen when I'm...
You the word.
Huh? That goes in Megillah. Yeah. By the way, the Gemara uses the phrase in Pesachim, Hagam lichbosh es hamalka, the Gemara uses it. This becomes an expression among the rabbis that whenever a younger rabbi tries to overrule his Rebbe in a matter of halacha, so the Rebbe would say to him, are you trying to conquer the queen while I'm still home? This is a phrase the Gemara uses in a lot of places. You know, you couldn't even wait? Couldn't even wait till I was out of town or something? You do it while I'm here? So now, Haman is speechless. Haman doesn't know what to do at all. I mean, the trees are being cut down. Ahasuerus now gets wind that he wants to kill Esther, and at the same time he's sexually enticing Esther, etc. And there's only one thing left, and that is a man called Charvona has his one line appearance in Megillah, and he says, oh, by the way, that tree that Mordechai made to hang Haman is 50 amos high, meaning to say that's another thing, because remember, Haman had come to Ahasuerus the night before to ask for permission to hang Mordechai. But of course, Haman never bothered to tell Ahasuerus that, because Ahasuerus started honoring Mordechai everything else. So now Charvona says, oh, by the way, are you aware of that nice tree that was built for to hang Mordechai? And of course, Mordechai is now the king's beloved friend, because he was reminded of the incident of Bigson Beseresh, and Ahasuerus said, actually says, Vayomer HaMelech, the king said, which also means God in Shamayim said, Taluhu Alav, hang him! And in a single day, on the second day of Pesach, Haman was hung on the very tree that he prepared for Mordechai. Now, Charvona is a very interesting thing. Charvona is, Lefi Pshuto, is nothing more than a Persian officer. He's just a chambermaid. He's not a chambermaid, but a chamberlain. A person of the king. And yet, we are told in our tradition, now, you know, there's a song that we sing after the Megillah reading called Shoshanas Yaakov, the rose or the lily of Yaakov, etc. So the song ends, you know, it says Haman should be cursed and Mordechai should be blessed and Zeresh should be cursed and Esther should be blessed. And at the end it says, Begam Charvona Zochur Matov. Charvona, good old Charvona, should also be remembered for good. So Charvona got his Olam Haba, so to speak, by just bringing up the idea of that tree, which resulted in Haman being
hung. So who's like a regular civilian?
Who's the what?
He was a regular person.
As far as me, he was a regular person. He was not. Haman was flesh and blood. Charvona was not even Jewish. But we do say Charvona Zachur Latov, and I see that the article has a nice comment here, because if it wouldn't be Charvona bringing that up exactly at that time, maybe Haman could still have wrangled his way out of it. I don't know, it doesn't seem that likely to me, but the point is that this was the straw that broke the camel's back. Until this point, maybe Haman could have explained it. Because the truth is, Haman had a lot of explanations. I mean, Haman could have said, first of all, hey, your majesty, you agreed to let me kill this nation. Number two, I didn't know Esther was a Jew. Number three, the trees being cut in the backyard, I didn't order. And number four, I was begging Esther. I mean, he could have explained it. Everything got explained. But this last thing already, too much. That's really the fourth strike. It's the genocide, and it's the cutting of the trees, and it's the attack against Esther, and it's the and this thing about Mordechai. So Memela, in such a case, he's out. So Charvona was the one that was considered to be responsible for the death of Haman. So Haman is hung that very day. So remember, I always emphasize the chronology here. This is the second day of Pesach.
and this is 11 months before the genocide against the Jews. Okay? And people have to remember the Megillah is not over at the end of chapter 7. There are 10 chapters of Megillah Esther. The story is not yet over, although Haman is hung. Now, Perek Ches says, the day that Haman was hung, Ahasuerus gave Esther the queen the house of Haman, and now finally she reveals who Mordechai is, her husband, etc. And the king takes the ring that he took away from Haman. Right, Haman was given royal authority, he gives it to Mordechai. So now Mordechai becomes the prime minister, etc. Now I think I had mentioned, just there is a halachic question that Mepharshim have here, and that is, if in fact Haman is from Amalek, and the mitzvah of destroying Amalek means not just to destroy their bodies, but also to destroy their property. Sure, destroy the animals, destroy the property. Then how was it halakhically permissible? Like this is a kasha that Mepharshim asked. How was it halakhically permissible for Esther to, in effect, take ownership of all of Haman's possessions and then give them to Mordechai? I mean, both how could Esther do it and how could Mordechai do it? So there are a few interpretations. One interpretation might be that the phrase the house of Haman does not refer to his actual estate. It does not refer to his property. The property may have been destroyed or whatever, it's kept by the king. But Beis Haman might refer to his office, his responsibility. In other words, right? If an Amaleki is Secretary of State and the Amaleki dies, no one's going to say the office of Secretary of State has been owned by Amalek and therefore we have to destroy it. Right? I mean, the office is not property that is owned. So if you interpret Beis Haman as official responsibilities, then you don't have a kasha. However, the problem is it's difficult to interpret Beis Haman as official responsibilities, because that seems to be what the next pasuk says, that Ahasuerus took off his ring and he gave it to Haman. Gave it to Mordechai. That seems to be the official responsibilities. So what's the Beis Haman? It's repeating itself. If Beis Haman means the responsibilities, then you don't have to repeat. So therefore, if Beis Haman means his property, we're back to square one. How could that property be given to Esther? So one answer that Mepharshim gives is the following. There is a rule in halacha that when people are executed because of their own averus, this is even in halacha, someone's executed because they desecrate Shabbos, their property goes to their heirs. Right? If Reuven is killed because he's mechalel Shabbos, the property goes to Reuven's kids. But if Reuven is executed because of treason against the king, the halachic rule is the property does not go to the heirs, the property goes to the king or the government. In ancient times, the king and the government were the same thing. There was no concept of public treasury apart from private treasury, similar to the Philippines or Singapore, where you still have that idea that the government treasury is, you know, the private expense accounts of the president. Now, therefore, the following. Since Haman was executed based on the fact that his actions were considered to be treason, either against Ahasuerus or against Esther, who was queen, consequently, all of Haman's property, from the standpoint of halacha, would have belonged to Ahasuerus. Now, there is a concept here that although a Jew is not allowed to acquire Amalekite property, if the Jew is acquiring it from another non-Jew who's a non-Amalekite, that will allow the Jew to take the property. In other words, Esther is getting the property not from Haman's ownership. Esther is getting the property via Ahasuerus' ownership. And under those principles, there is no prohibition of property of Amalek. Now, what proof for that proposition? The proof is actually a Gemara dealing with another matter. And that is, if you remember, at the end of the book of Bamidbar, the two tribes, I remember Moshe Rabbeinu waged war against Sihon, the king of Amori, and Og, the king of Bashan, and Klal Yisrael conquered those lands on the east bank of the Jordan, And later, those lands were given to the tribes of Reuven, Gad, and half of Manasseh. Now, the Torah makes the point that Jews are not allowed to conquer Moabite territory. The land that belonged to Moab, Moab was Lot's children, remains Moabite land. We're not allowed to conquer that land. And yet, the Torah also emphasizes that Sichon, the king of Amori, had conquered that land from Moab, and yet the Jews are allowed to occupy it. So how could the Jews occupy that land if it belonged to Moab? The answer, the Gemara says, is Moab's land became purified, as it were, through Sichon's conquest. Meaning, the Jewish people are not taking the land from Moab. They are taking the land from Sichon. Sichon is Amori. And therefore, the prohibition against taking Moabite land does not apply if the Jewish people are taking it from another nation which conquered Moab. Now, that's a Gemara. That's a Mefarish Gemara. So the Oneg Yavtif, one of the great Achronim, wants to say that the same heter of Moab becoming permitted to the Jewish people via the conquest of Sichon also applies to the property of Amalek being permitted to the Jewish people via the intervention of Achashverosh. And since Achashverosh owns the land, because those who rebel against the king forfeit their property to the king, therefore Esther is getting it from Achashverosh. And that's why it's very meduyek. If you look at Pasuk, very exact, Perek Ches Pasuk Aleph, it emphasizes Achashverosh gave Esther Haman's property. Now, when you say Achashverosh gave, that implies Achashverosh is the owner of the property. Why is Achashverosh the owner of the property? Because of the halacha that says, Moed b'malchus, he who rebels against the king, nichseihem lamelech, their property belongs to the king. It's now Achashverosh's property, and that takes off the idea of Amalek. Now, the truth of the matter is, if you would look at this from the straight idea of logic, I think the Oneg Yomtov's comparison is not as good a comparison as one might think. Because when it comes to Moab, the Torah's main concern is that the Jewish people do not have a right to dispossess Moab from the land that Hashem gave them. So consequently, doesn't it stand to reason? If the Moabites aren't living there anymore, and it's Amori that's living there, there's no problem. There's no Moab. The Torah didn't so much say, you can't take this land. The Torah basically said, you can't kick out the Moabites. Consequently, if the Moabites are already kicked out, I can take the land. When it comes to Amalek, it's a different idea. When it comes to Amalek, the Torah says, Amalek is so hated that we need to eradicate every last trace of their existence. So consequently, I'm not sure if just because the land was not owned by Amalek, if people remember this was Haman's property, you still have that remnant. So I would suggest, again, I don't have another answer to this question, but I would suggest that the Oneg Yomtov's comparison to the law of Moab and applying that principle to Amalek is not necessarily 100% clear, because one could differentiate between the Moab problem and the Amalek problem. The Moab problem, where the whole issue is to kick the Moabites out of their land, one could say, if they're not there anyway, I could take the land. Here, the idea of Amalek is to ensure that there's no remnant and memory of Amalek. But of course, you have other problems, because if we're dealing with Amalek, our problem is Haman's kids are going to be killed, as we'll see, but Haman's grandsons are still alive. They weren't eradicated anyway. So this was not a complete destruction. But I'll tell you, though, that this is where we have an inconsistency. You know, you'll notice that towards the end of the Megillah, when the Jews fight against their enemies, the Navi emphasizes twice or three times that the Jews did not take the spoils of the war. Ubabiza lo shalchu es yadam. The Jews did not take any spoils. Now, why didn't the Jews take the spoils? So, there are a lot of reasons. We'll talk about it at more length towards later. But one reason is, so people shouldn't think the Jews are just killing to get money. They're killing because these are their people who are going to kill them. But some want to suggest the Jews didn't want to take the spoils because many of the people they killed were Amalekim. and they're not allowed to get benefit from a mullah. So on one hand, they didn't get benefits. On the other hand, we have Esther taking the house of Haman. So you do have that.
And they weren't married by Malchus.
Right, they weren't married by Malchus, yeah. So at that point, when they were killed, it was their property, and that's why they couldn't take it. Okay, I'm sorry, what time do you have? Oh, it's they passed already. Okay, so we'll stop here. Got a piece of work.
That's the answer. Machashverosh gave her two things that she asked for. She asked for two things.
Right.
She asked for herself and her people.
Right.
She asked, why is she asking one's included in the other?
Yeah, I have to check it. The Vilna Gaon, has a chiluk between what she'ela is and bakasha is. I remember Machashverosh said, what is your she'ela, what is your bakasha? Achashverosh himself split it into two, and she is answering in accordance with the way he asked.
Yeah, but her answer, she asked something better than that.
Well, not too much. He already ruled out the building of the Beis HaMikdash when he said up to half the kingdom. So not too much.
She could say, "I'm Jewish." It's for her nation. She's self-included,
right?
And then she can get
in other words, that gives her one extra wish. Right. Yeah. The Gra talks about it. I'll have to check it. I don't remember the other time.